The Babylon Project was our last best hope for peace. It failed, but in the year of the Shadow War, it became something greater, our last best hope for victory. The year is 2260. The place, Babylon 5. I'm Chris Spivey.
And I'm Eddie Webb.
And today, we talk about Babylon 5 on Genreless.
And we're still figuring things out, but that's fine. It's episode two. We're still sorting out the process.
I promise to only make 6 or 7 mistakes per 10 minutes. So if people want to take out their timers, we can get started. So I guess one of the first things that's going to change a little bit is that for Babylon 5, initially we talked about only doing pilots, but Babylon 5 is such a serialized show that you have to give some spoilers, and we have to talk more about the show somewhat in depth to kind of give like an overview and talk about some of the greatness that it has.
Yeah. I mean, when we first talked about the show, I had this idea of the pilot's a good kind of representative view into the show. And then almost immediately Chris is like, but that's not true for Babylon 5. And he's correct. So we made some different decisions. I think just going forward, we're not going to keep ourselves to the pilot in 2 episodes. It's going to be just 3 representative episodes.
For instance, Babylon 5, if you want to see the pilot, you have your choice of the gathering edited, the in the beginning that sort of like is they did at the end that sort of told a prequel that led up into the show, or the first episode that was kind of a pilot. I think it was called like In the Firing Line, which sort of recapitulates all of those different shows into one 45-minute real action-packed piece. And during the transition of the pilot being picked up to the first episode, it was about a year and a half, and they lost cast members. They replaced cast members with other people, and that sort of established the main crew of folks.
That's a lot.
And to move from that, we're going to talk about 3 specific episodes today. So if you haven't watched them yet, since we're doing this so like off the cuff, Eddie, I think what we might want to start doing is like we tell the people the episodes in future of what the shows are going to watch, if they want to watch them in advance, so we don't have to have them take a break from the show to like go watch the episodes and come back. Just a random thought.
That's a good plan. We could turn this more into a reading club, and for people listening, you know, like I said, we're still figuring this out. So I mean, you know, you're hearing this as we evolve this, that's a good thing. So luckily I've already picked out my episodes for next week, so we're good on that front.
You're so advanced. You're so awesome. I myself have still not figured out what the next ones are for when my turn comes around. Homework.
We have some time.
So today we're going to talk about Chrysalis, which is the season 1, episode 22, sort of the season 1 finale. The Coming of Shadows from season 2, episode 9, and Severed Dream, season 3, episode 10. I think those give a great encapsulation, a great sort of overview of the show, and puts you in the heart of the plot.
Mm-hmm. I will say, I had watched it before, although it's been easily a decade. Some of this is, I do remember vague bits of it, but I don't remember much of it. And watching these 3 episodes, you're right. I never really felt lost. The show is very clever in how it quietly recaps things. It doesn't do a previously on like I thought maybe they did, but it's rather just in the course of the show, they'll say, oh, this is the thing that we're talking about. And you know, they'll play a clip or they'll flash back to something. And so I actually was never lost, even though I'm watching 3 episodes across 3 seasons.
And that's great because like Chrysalis, you have Commander Sinclair, who is only there at the initial for that first season. The first season of the entire show was almost kind of like a prequel, because when Straczynski originally plotted out the show, it was sort of written like a serialized novel over 5 seasons, and each episode was supposed to be in a chapter, and each season arc is sort of like a main chunk of the book themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great to see a show that had a prequel that will lead you into everything and introduce you to the characters. You can see sort of how they evolve over the course of the entire show. And even in the first episode, if people go back and watch it, one of the lines that Jakar says is that nothing here is as it appears. And you can see the depth and complexity of all the characters as they evolve.
Mm-hmm.
If we just want to dive into Chrysalis, I guess, then, what were your initial thoughts of it?
So Crystalis, again, like I said, is interesting because like prequel feel you're talking about, I didn't really feel that was necessarily lost per se. It does set the stakes pretty well. There was a couple things like, you know, Delenn going into the Crystalis, the titular Crystalis. That was a little vague to me in terms of like, why is this happening? Why is this important? But I trusted that that was explained in other episodes I hadn't watched. But like, it does a really good job of kind of showing you, okay, this is what's going on. We have a space station. It's a diplomatic effort primarily. There are ambassadors here, and the politics are going to be a noteworthy part of this. And also there's some spy intrigue, you know, with Garibaldi's investigation. There's, the Earth president being assassinated through Earth Force One. And even in the little bit you see of that assassination attempt and then Vice President Clark becoming President Clark, the show does a really good job of quietly showing you this is clearly a noteworthy event, and also bad things are going to happen from this, because like I think it was like almost immediately Clark was like, we're going to focus on Earth now. Very kind of early World War II America of like, you know, that's somebody else's problem. We're going to focus on home, domestic concerns. And it was, I think it did a really good job of setting the stage. If I did not realize this was the end of season one, it would have felt like a really strong pilot.
Which is one of the reasons I wanted to choose it, because it sort of resets the stage for the rest of the show going on. And it highlights all the characters. For instance, Sinclair, if you watch the entire first season, always has a feeling of someone that's in a role that is too large for them, and they know it, but they're still doing the best they can. And he wants to be successful and try to do everything he can, but he still wants to have his own life. It goes back to a reference from last episode when I talked about how Pike sort of had that weariness about him, but still just doing the job. And Sinclair has that. And you can tell that he's burnt out just from seeing the... There is also the personal aspects for the actor himself, who had to leave the show due to personal reasons. But that is also reflected in the character in the script that was written, as he keeps trying to succeed, but every time he shows up too late to do this. He showed up too late to save the president. He showed up too late to talk to Delenn about this important thing that she needed to tell him. And that is constantly reinforced. And like the gravitas of the situation is overwhelming.
One thing that Crystalis really does that the other episodes build on to good effect is at this stage, this is mid-90s, genre television has a certain kind of cadence and structure. And so there are certain tropes and formats that we associate with. Like if the alien ambassador says, I need you to meet with me privately, you expect, you know, it's important to do that. You expect them to eventually either come in just before or just after that moment. That's kind of how genre television expects you to be. Like this is going to be the big climax, and the hero comes in right before or right after and whatever. And the fact that he just completely misses it entirely sets the stages for that. We're going to set things up, but they're not going to play off in the way that you're used to in traditional 90s genre television.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so, I mean, playing off of that, like, the stakes are interesting, but at this point in the show, they still feel a little artificial. Like, a president dies pretty much off camera. I mean, you get a little bit of footage through a lens, but you don't see it. Someone else gets put in. And it's like, okay, people die, but it doesn't seem like anybody meaningful dies. That clearly changes in later episodes. But it's interesting that for me, while watching this, so many shows prior to this tried to play with politics and just never really got into it because you need space to do a strong political drama. Because this is in a lot of ways, it's West Wing in space, right? It's a political thriller.
So that was one of Straczynski's like writing things that he'd set out. He wanted a show written for adults that would have depth and meaning for characters, and it would interact with like the military aspects and the political aspects and tell it in a realistic, I'm using air quotes, that no one can see because we're on a podcast, realistic manner. And that's portrayed from, I think, the mix of the diplomats and how if someone watches it, they can see the perspectives change over the course of the show and how they certain events change each character and how they attempt to use their political clout. And a lot of this for Londo is someone from an imperial sort of society that was on the decline that wanted to be someone of importance and was willing to sacrifice any fiber of morality to have that happen for himself.
Yeah, that was another thing that is really interesting. I'm now moving a little bit into The Coming of Shadows because I think that's a better Londo showcase. But Londo's, it reminded me just how interesting of a character Londo is, because if you look at his actions in summary, he comes across straight up as a villain. I mean, it's like he wants the throne. He makes deals with shady people. He, you know, has a colony entirely wiped out to promote his own gains. But each of those moments, you definitely get that kind of almost Shakespearean vibe of he's not entirely in control. He thinks he is, and he feels like this is what he needs to do, but also there's a reticence and a reluctance that when he makes the inevitable bad decision, you actually feel bad for him. It's like, no, you don't have to do this. And then he just does. It's like, but then you know he has to do that, right? It's like that's the character he is. He's got to make that bad decision. But the way the actor plays it and the way the script is written, you feel a gut punch every time Londo makes that shitty decision with the shadows or whatever. It's like, oh no, you don't. Why'd you do that, man?
It's like when Morden came to when he went to Morden and said, "You killed, I think it was 10,000 Narns at first," and Morden says, "Do you care?" And there was no response from Londo. There's sort of a, I should care, but he doesn't acknowledge it or say that he does. So it's like that level of it. You can see there's a want to concern, but there's a lack of concern compared to what he's gaining for that.
Right. And I think at this point we just move to The Coming in Shadows because it's such a Londo story. The Emperor of this entire Republic is... he's dying. He actually comes to Babylon 5, not really telling much to anybody. And he's there to try to actually try to put his hand out and actually make an overture towards the Narns in a way that has never been done in history. And it's just, it's happening simultaneous to a different plan that Londo's having to wipe out a Narn outpost. And the Emperor dies. The Emperor manages to talk to Jakar, the Narn representative, and then dies. And so for like 24 hours...
We should also mention that when he was coming there, Jakar originally intended to try to assassinate him after he tried to convince
the new commander,
Sheridan, that they should not be allowed in the ship for the atrocities they've committed against the Narn Empire. And one of the great things about the transition of commanders is that changes the dynamic of all the other cast as they interact with this new person in charge. For instance, with Sinclair, you had someone who was world weary. Sheridan, you had like a war hero coming in with nothing but bright-eyed optimism, telling him, like, you could do this. All you got to do is get out there, put all your old grievances aside. 100 years of bloodshed are nothing. Just like go in and talk to him. And Jakar is trying to explain to him that you can't do that. There's a history there that just isn't overcome by like one person. And that is a great contrast. And when he actually goes to attempt to assassinate him, but fails because the Emperor has a heart attack. And there's this great confrontation between the Earth forces and Jakar to stop him from going in to kill. Sorry, I moved ahead of myself. I'm going to hold off on that because that's a little spoiler for later. That one is spoiled. But it was great to be able to see the interaction between all of them and how Sheridan is trying to push him to do something that would be more diplomatic than a straight up assassination of the person.
Right. And the show does a great job of nobody's exactly right. Nobody's exactly wrong. Right. Jakar is not entirely wrong. You can't just ignore 100 years of bloodshed. Someone has to account for that on some level. Sheridan's also right that at some point, someone has to make the first step, and no one's making that. And again, ironically, it's the Emperor that actually does make that first step and then dies.
And then you have the jubilation that Jakar feels that the head of the entire Centauri Republic has come to apologize and try to make amends. And so now he's hoping that this person who's going to kill will recover, and that could potentially change the course of the galaxy. That is one person making a difference.
Yep. And then 24 hours later, he finds out. And the voice is like, as this is happening is when the destruction happens. Jakar doesn't find out until a day later. So he spends a whole day apologizing to Londo and drinking with him. And the whole time, Londo knows what he did.
And this is one of those moments you're talking about. It was great to see the look on Londo's face when he goes, crap, I have destroyed everything. If I had, if I'd even held off one more day, potentially there wouldn't be this war that is going to happen between us. And there could have actually been a peace and unity between all of us.
And a lot of that I think really helps with, is it Veer, his assistant?
Yes, Veer. Ah, Veer's amazing.
So Stephen Furst plays Veer, and I remember season one, he was kind of comic relief. He was the put upon assistant to the arrogant, overblown ambassador. But here you start to see Veer has moved into, he is the conscience. He's vocalizing Londo's conscience. And Veer explicitly is like, he's being dead serious here. The scenes are played, they're not at all played for humor. And it's like, you don't have to do this. And Veer is so blunt and front with Londo because he's the only person who will tell Londo to his face he's doing something wrong. So it's a really fantastic dynamic that this character who's meant to be a joke character has already pretty quickly evolved into an amazing counterpoint. And because he's so funny, he's also human. Like there's a scene earlier on where Londo's complaining. I love this scene so much. Londo's complaining. He's like, oh, this thing's happening. This thing's happening. And it's like being nibbled by an earth creature with Bill and Bugs. And Vera goes, cats. Like, yes, nibbled to death by cats. And they're both playing it so straight, and the comedic timing is fantastic. So when it flips into a heavy drama scene, that same timing gives such weight and depth because you really love Veer because he's the funny character that you can relate to. And so the character you relate to is saying the things that you, the audience, want to say. He's like, you don't have to do this. And then he goes and does it. And it's just like, oh, it's so heartbreaking. But again, it's almost inevitable. The one thing I love about Bebop, especially the first few seasons, is that you feel like someone could have made a difference at any stage, but also as a part of you realizes it was going to go this way no matter what.
Oh, it's so true, because it's all about choices. And each of them makes a choice, and then you're paying the repercussions for that choice. And for instance, even Veer, who is an amazing character, but Veer, you have to remember, is sort of Londo's assistant. He could be fired, sent back at any point in time. And the way that he stands up to Londo, and then he stands up to Rifa, who is Londo's sort of cohort in this society where he would easily be 3 to 8 tiers lower than they are, is an impressive character feat for someone to do. Because you're bucking the system that you're raised under. Much like when the Emperor comes to B5, he doesn't bring all the pomp and circumstance that was trying to be thrust upon him when he's doing it. He's going as himself. He's going as humble as possible to do this thing. And his note to meet Jakar and tell him what he thinks, he doesn't tell to his own people because he knows he can't trust them. He tells to Dr. Franklin, one of the B5 members, who has to go and get Londo to come to tell him that. Like, there's already an acknowledgement that his people don't want this to happen, or at least the people surrounding him don't want this to happen. And he's still trying to circumvent it, which then makes you wonder more about that character, that they've lived this life as emperor for this, I would have to say, almost like Talatorian race that's imprisoned and enslaved other people. And he's gone along with it up until almost his deathbed. So that still has to be taken into account for the character while doing this amazing thing. What did they do before? Why didn't they use the time and the power that they had to try to make a difference?
And it also kind of interestingly gives context back to Londo, because you very much see like that this society is, like you said, very regimented. Like everyone has their role and their role to play, and behind closed doors they can scheme and manipulate and try to get things done, but they can't be visibly shown to have gone against status quo, which is why, because when the Emperor makes these noises, the other supporting characters are scandalized by this, right? It's like, oh my god, no, you can't do that. And even when the Emperor dies and he whispers to Londo, and Londo says, you know, because like, you know, what, you know, they're, you know, what should we do? You know, should we go to war? And the Emperor whispers to him, and Londo's like, you know, he says, continue. He says, bring, you know, our empire back. And then outside, his cohort is like, you know, what are you really saying? It's like, you are both damned. And it's like, so it's like, Londo is kind of also stuck in this role of like, we've made this role. I have this opportunity to push things along status quo because I can't go again. I'm caught up in the momentum of the moment. And so each lie, he's building himself deeper. And to have the one man who made a courageous gesture damn him is such, again, it's a knife twist. And again, it's so weird because everyone talks about characters like Darth Vader, like, you know, conflicted villains and whatnot. But like Londo is one of the best in my mind.
Hands down.
And Jakar. And also Jakar is great too, because Jakar is not, also, he's not the simple counterpoint to that. He's not the goody good two shoes. Jakar also done some awful, awful stuff.
Well, if people really want to go and watch first season, it's almost an inverse now, because it's almost more of a first season. Jakar was sort of the villain, and mm-hmm. they played that up heavily in the pilot movie, and throughout the entire season, he's doing, we'll be nice and call them questionable things throughout the entire show. And Londo is more of comic relief, and you're feel some sympathy for Londo, which is one of the reasons why it's so amazing when it sort of shifts at the end of that season. And Londo starts his ascension up to a villain, and Jakar starts his descent from a villain into becoming more of a heroic-esque character. And he turns mm-hmm. more to their, I think it was their religion, when like the Book of Jaquan,
I think that's right,
to find meaning in what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Right. And speaking of evolving things, unless you have something else to say, I think we can move to Severed Dreams.
Before that, I want to go back to my spoiler that I almost spoiled earlier.
Oh, yeah, I did that one, yeah.
Is that after Jakar finds out about that, what happened to, I think it was like one of their largest planets, he decides mm-hmm. he has to kill Londo, and he runs to kill Londo, and he encounters Earth Force, Sheridan, and everyone else. Mm-hmm. And right. they in the confrontation, they tell him that he needs to not think about himself, but think about his people. And like, mm-hmm. where can he do the most good? And you get to see the conflict between righteous fury and having to walk the harder path to mm-hmm. rebuild something, to like think more about the long-term situation and where you can add your influence and power and be the most beneficial to your entire group of people. And so to see him then crumple is acknowledging that, like, I can't do this thing that I could do because I can't think about me. I need to think about all those people that are on that planet that need to be saved, how I can help them long term and better. And it's that thing that it's harder to build something than it is to destroy something is easy. And that is a yeah. constant theme throughout the entire show. Just like over and over again, it is encapsulated in 2 minutes, beautifully.
And also for my money, the fact that they reinforce how hard it is, but the fact that it fails a lot. Because season three, like you read at the beginning of the episode, season three is, we had, Babylon 5 was our last best hope for peace, and it failed. We are at war now. So, I mean, it's really bold to be able to set up, because, I mean, again, genre expectations are, well, of course, they're eventually all going to get together and be friends because that's the premise of the show. And it's like, nope, we're going a different direction. It's just like, wait, what? What is going on here? So, yeah, it's really bold to kind of make that kind of strong step.
And I guess one more point before we move on to Severed Dreams is the B story of that, of the entire episode, is this mysterious person sort of wandering around the station who Garibaldi eventually has a discussion with. And you find that Commander Sinclair was sent to Minbari as an ambassador. But in fact, he's actually now head of some sort of organization, and there's some sort of greater enemy that's at large. And they don't know what it is, but we as viewers know that they've stumbled on and they're talking about the shadows, and they're trying to figure out how to stop the shadows without letting the shadows know they know who they are. And the shadows are this, the evil force basically that Lana is working with that destroyed the Narn base, who Mr. Morden works for and has been sort of manipulating things from the background.
And that actually goes to what I was going to originally say about Severed Dreams, is that the Minbari are kind of a weird thing for a while, because you hear characters talk about, particularly when Sheridan comes on board, this is me remembering bits and pieces of the show now, that Sheridan was like one of the few pilots who survived the war with the Minbari. Earth went to war with the Minbari and pretty much lost. And so you have the memory, but throughout most of the show, Delenn and most of the Minbari are kind of quiet, spiritual characters that just don't feel like the warlike beings we have been sold throughout this show, right? And then Severed Dreams happens. And super short version, which is, does disservice to the plot, but basically it's Earth Force Civil War. The president is forcing the military to enact illegal orders.
A little too close to reality.
This is not at all relevant.
Of last administration.
Yeah, I was definitely thinking that watching this whole episode. It's like, this is 20 years too early, but okay. But I mean, some of the military just refused to enact that order, and it becomes, basically a civil war between different factions of the Earth Force military. And again, it was that feeling of inevitability, because like a couple of ships defect over. It's clear from previous episodes that Babylon 5 was kind of quietly giving them support. But Babylon 5 is pushed in a position where they have to openly declare what side they're on. And so Sheridan struggles with this decision for a while, but ultimately he talks to his dad. His dad says, I know you made the right decision. He declares, along with a couple of other colonies, declares that they're going to be independent until the president steps down. And some military ships show up to, basically arrest them. And the whole time, there's lots of talking between both the allied commanders and also with the antagonistic commanders of the different faction. Like, you don't have to do this. Just walk away. And they're like, all you have to do is just stand down. You know, I mean, nobody wants this fight. And then the fight happens. And it is glorious 90s CGI fight. But I mean, it's good long space battle. I mean, it does not shy away from it. And ships get killed. Characters that we've seen die. The consequences of this fight are real, and also Babylon 5 is losing. They've only got a couple of ships. They managed to get through one chunk of the battle, and then reinforcements show up just as they're basically beaten down. They're just like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And then the Minbari show up. And Delenn is – the B plot is Delenn is trying to convince the Minbari to intercede, and they're just not having it. Eventually she – pull some strings in the council for reasons that were unclear. I think they were established in previous episodes, but to me they were a little unclear. But ultimately she's like, I have some dirt on y'all. You need to do this. And a good chunk of the council go with her. And so they show up to defend Babylon 5. And again, fantastic, quotable show. She's like, the only human who stood against my people, is Sheridan. He is behind me. You are in front of me. And I got chills looking at it, because again, we've seen for, even watching this briefing of two episodes, but 2.5 seasons of them being quiet, meek little people. And then they're just like slapping it down, like, no, you know, we will obliterate you. And then the other Earth Force ship's like, nope, we're gone. We're out.
Well, because one of the big things is for the Earth-Minbari War, it was the Earthers sort of like destroyed the first Minbari people they encountered because they misunderstood them, their gesture of peace. And then a war sort of happened. And throughout the entire war, Earth lost every single encounter except for the one that Sheridan was. And Sheridan was the only commander to ever defeat them in combat. And during the show, you'll find out how he did it. And it wasn't like a glorious, we stand, you stand, and I've beaten you. It was a sneaky move that won. And so, like, that is sort of like sort of the one of the reasons that he was really sent there by President Clark is because Clark thought he had someone who would be antagonistic towards aliens because Sheridan had defeated the Minbari. And in reality, he sent someone who was there that believed in military service and trying to do everything they could to help their people. And so that doesn't necessarily mean doing what a politician tells you, but doing what's best. And so that was, go back as a soldier, that is a, I love seeing that. And I loved seeing the conflict between some of the actual military people as they had to fight other military members, almost like the Civil War, where you, you know the people that you're fighting. You potentially know the people that you're killing. And there's this, so it brings an extra level of something where the commander of a ship knows the other commander who's killed and talks about that commander's wife, their kids, their cat, and what he has to think of to say to them when all this is over. Like, those are consequences for actions and them not wanting to fire. And you're talking like some of the great quotes from the show. One that I still love is Sheridan talks to his dad. And he's in Sheridan's, he repeats back what his dad told him, never start a fight, but always finish it. And that is something I've loved and something I always live by. And I kind of teach my own kid that it's important. You don't, if you can talk to someone and reach a diplomatic understanding and like negotiate, that's great. But if someone starts a fight with you, you need to end it. You don't run away from it, even if you don't want it.
Right. Because running away from the fight doesn't end it. It just makes, it just prolongs it.
Absolutely.
And yeah, and it's, I'm glad you picked this to watch right after Star Trek because the role of the military is so different because for much as I love the original Star Trek, the militaristic trappings are just that. They're just trappings. You don't actually really get to see the actual role of the military in Starfleet. It's more just a way to kind of differentiate, delineate the crew, right? Rank occasionally comes up, but not very often. It's pretty low key. Whereas this, you're digging into, like you said, real actual discussions of military history. Because like Babylon 5 is ultimately, like, it's a military outpost. It is run by a military governor. It is an Earth Force outpost that is very clear, not only through the actions and the commentary, but also just the way the sets are designed. You see the Earth Force logo everywhere.
Which,
it,
I guess,
it's the equivalent.
Wow. We should also mention that originally it was built in neutral territory, so no one owned it, so that's why it could be a diplomatic station for all the different races to come to.
Okay, I had forgotten that part. But certainly by this point, it's the way everyone's reacting to it. It's if it's not explicitly an Earth Force location, it's de facto Earth Force location. And again, like you're saying, it's not only the relationship of the military with each other and the legality of orders and what happens when the politicians interfere with military structure, but also the role of the media is a huge part of the show that I've forgotten about. It was really good. There's an entire plot point in Severed Dreams about what got sent to the media and when and how the media is reacting to things. And Sheridan has to manipulate the media at some point to get his goal across. And it's really fascinating.
Like, for me, this was my favorite all-time science fiction television show because I've always loved plots, I've loved characters, and the fact it wasn't sort of a standalone episode constantly, but something that had an ongoing narrative that evolved and the level of complexity. Because even when we talk about one episode, we're leaving out multiple subplots. Even just talking about this, because we discussed briefly the Narn and how the Narn and Centauri went to war. And you find out that during the course of that, somehow by separate dreams, the Narns have been enlisted by the B5 staff to do security. So they have Narn security on the station, which sort of reinforces what they're trying to do for peace and prosperity. And you have the Centauri who are complaining about the Narn being there. So you have that constant struggle between all of those different aspects going on. And even running under all of that subplot, there's a greater shadow war. And then there is the building war that potentially is going to happen with Earth before it's announced in this episode where Babylon 5 succeeds from them. And all of those things are constantly ongoing. There's little building tidbits. Because even throughout all of season 2, President Clark enforces something called the Night Watch, which is basically kind of his own secret police to go in and harass and terrorize people to like sort of seed out everything and in using fear as a tactic. Mm. And that is beautifully written, and it encapsulates so well what real-ish society does and what you see when you have corrupt political people in command, more corrupt than normal.
Right. And you mentioned at the beginning that this was structured by novels, like novels, and I think that's really fair to say. When I first watched this, I did actually start watching this way back in like the early 90s, and I bounced off it immediately because it was so serialized. And I missed a couple episodes, and I was like, well, I have no idea what's going on now, so I just opted out. This is written like a modern Netflix show in the sense that it's eminently bingeable. I had to stop myself from just watching the next episode. Now I have to watch the three we talked about because I want to watch the rest of this. I remember the show. It's so great. But it is. Each one is a chapter and ends like a good novel. There are those plots threading through. So like you'll see like a scene in one episode that doesn't really mean much, but then that becomes the B plot of the next episode and then the A plot of a further episode. While in those subsequent episodes, there's another C plot and A plot and B plot all kind of wrapped around. So like these plots keep like popping up. Like there's a whole thread in season one of this guy who was just kind of generic background Garibaldi agent. And Jack, I think his name is. And Jack's just there. And he very much is structured like, oh, this is the cameo walk-on guy, gets two lines. And he's the one who actually turns traitor on Garibaldi. And it's such a long burn, like a whole season of just like, oh, this is a background guy, but I kind of vaguely recognize him. Oh, wait, his name is Jack. Okay, I kind of recognize him. Now I know his name is Jack. But it's probably just some character actor that just got like a few lines here and there. And it turns out that he's actually got a significant part. And it's just like, whoa, because it's such a long way of looking at things that television just wasn't done at that time. It's something that we see a lot of now, but the fact that this is happening 15 years ago, 20 years ago, is immensely impressive.
And not only that, I think they were one of the first shows to actually use CGI. And it was somewhat looked down upon when they were doing it. They didn't necessarily have the budget to do it, but they needed a way to show these great epic space battles. And that was something that wasn't done. And they sort of like even started at the forefront for that. There's so many things it did, and it even portrayed, I think, one of the first sci-fi on television same-sex relationships.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I joked about the 90s CGI earlier, but, I mean, it aged pretty well, all things considered, honestly. The stage titles were pretty good. I wasn't looking back. I mean, I've seen just other shows from that time period and their CGI, and this is far and away a lot better.
So
space battles were compelling.
I will say, if you haven't seen it, it is worth going back and saying, I will stipulate that though. You only need to watch maybe two episodes of first season, maybe three. While I, at the time watching it when it first aired, it was great. It was gripping. It is not something that you need to really enjoy the rest of the show. You just sort of need like the seeds of that, as there are a lot of bad episodes because they were forced to have, I think back then, the 22 episode order. So there are some key episodes and there's a lot of filler to sort of like move things along. But that filler did let you see, for instance, like I think Jack showed up in a couple of those filler episodes and you got to see that character reoccur. But the plots there aren't really worth it. For instance, I can name one episode, TKO, you can just skip.
And while they have these threaded subplots, one thing that's interesting is that it hasn't completely escaped from the trappings of 90s television. So each episode generally has a strong plot that begins and resolves in it. So yeah, there are certain episodes where like maybe you're missing a progression of a small plot, but the actual core arc is something you can kind of skip. I haven't done this research for this, but I know for other shows there are essential episode watch guides, which get you kind of you can avoid the filler and say, here's the episode you watch, and occasionally it's like, okay, you need to know this one piece of information before you watch these episodes, kind of thing. So if you're strapped for time, I may do that actually, do an essential kind of, you know, key episode watch, because I have watched it all the way through, but I just watching again, I was like, oh my God, I remember how much I loved this show. And I was like, I devoured. I think I tore through all five box sets in like 2 weeks.
So thinking about last week though, when I was rewatching these, I actually thought to myself that the feel of some of this is reminiscent of The Cage. Like I could almost imagine if The Cage was a serialized television show, it would have been almost on par or similar to B5, except more of an exploration aspect of it.
I could totally see that, because again, you've got that The Cage definitely felt a little more like it was tapping into that, making some valued use of that military structure that again regular TOS kind of just abandons. But also, you know, the struggle of making, because the first contact in The Cage does not go well.
No,
and that's something else that Babylon 5 does well, is that, you know, Star Trek has idealized humans that act in ideal ways. Babylon 5 has idealized humans that act in human ways. And I think you're right, The Cage does more of the latter. They're both good. Again, I mean, obviously I love both. So both different things, but Babylon 5 is like, you see everyone trying to do the best, but then they just stumble. And then it's like, again, they stumble again. Yeah. And that's the worst part, because like sometimes in some shows, drama can be forced, right? It's like how many shows have we all seen which some form of, if two people sat in a room for 5 minutes, had a conversation, this would be over, but they don't. And so you have plot. This is not that. This show is, they are sitting in a room having a conversation and it just gets worse. It's like talking is not helping. Fighting is not helping. Nothing's helping.
Well, I think one of the best highlights of that was actually in season one, episode 22 that we're talking about, because at the end of it, you sort of have, before the president's assassinated, you have Sinclair talking to a politician on Earth saying, my security chief found out about the president's assassination. We need to do something now. And the politician is like, I don't believe you. My agents would have found out. And he's like, you're not listening to what I'm saying. And she says, you're not saying anything worth listening to.
Yeah. Again, such a quotable show. Oh my God, there's so many good quotes in this show.
Like that's, beautiful.
Yeah. So curse you, because I definitely want to rewatch this now.
I could wax poetic about B5 for like another hour or so.
Totally. I watched it on Hulu. I got the impression it was remastered or upscaled in some ways, so I don't know if that applied to like the CGI or whatnot. I could not get any information on that.
It has been remastered. I have the box set and I have it on iTunes, and I know iTunes is showing the remastered version, but there is some still issues with the remaster, because if I remember right, they were shot at the wrong angle or something, so they've had some problems during remasters. One of their producers went a little bit cheap at the time, and that sort of caused problems now for remasters.
Yeah, I know some of the 90s era Star Treks have similar problems. The change in camera technology is making it harder for remastering.
Having seen them now, who do you prefer as your commander, Sinclair or Sheridan? And I'm going to ask you a harder one in a minute.
Okay. I think it is Sheridan. I mean, that's the easy answer, but I feel somewhat Sinclair just wasn't, like you said, kind of wasn't in the right place at the right time. I don't know how much that was the actor and how much of that was the character. I think it's probably a little bit of both. But one thing I like to do like for Shakespearean plays is to swap protagonists and like how would, you know, this character have done in that place circumstances. And it'd be interesting to me, like if Sheridan had actually ridden through all of this, I feel like it would have been a very different show. But also, I'm sorry, if Sinclair had gone all the way through, I should say. If Sinclair had gone all the way through, I think it would have been a very different show. And if Sheridan started, I think it would have also been a different first year.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not just a case of, well, crap, the actor left, we have to recast it. There was thought in terms of making these distinct characters. So this is a valid question. But I do think watching Sheridan's idealism break and then mature into a more realistic form of idealism is a really compelling character arc.
So can you rank all four captains in order that you think would be the, we won't even say follow to follow, but would be the coolest. Let's go over the different barometer.
The Star Trek captains?
The Star Trek and the B5 captains.
Oh, okay. I actually put Kirk dead last, not because I don't like Kirk, just because he doesn't really have a character arc. And Pike, like we talked about before last episode, has kind of a character arc, even in that one episode, which is interesting. I would probably put Pike above Sinclair because you talk about burning out, whereas with Sinclair, at least the episode I saw was very much like the he's on the way out. And again, I understand probably they were writing him out as a character. But he was like, you know what? On second thought, military is not for me. And then he finds a new way to contribute to the effort, which works better for him. Whereas Pike's like, I'm burning out, but I'm going to try to make this work. And that's, on a personal level, working through burnout is a terrible method. But from a dramatic perspective, it's really honestly, of the four, Sheridan is the most interesting to me. If nothing else, because how he works with his staff is really interesting. Like, the Star Trek captains can be a bit micromanagey. They always go down to importance beam downs and, you know, they have all the key negotiations. Sheridan playing time is like going, Garibaldi, you just go take care of this. This is not my problem. I need to focus on something else right now. And he just lets Garibaldi do it. He lets Ivanova just, you know, like she's going to go fly out. And he's like, no, you have to stay here. And she's like, you know, this is the right thing to do. Let me do this. She stands up to him and he accepts that she has a better perspective on this than he does and takes her advice, which is something that you just don't see Star Trek captains do all that often.
It's signs of a great leader.
Yeah, it is. It's the surround yourself by people that are smarter than you and they'll stand up to you. But still respect you. And you can tell that because Ivanova and Garibaldi, you know, obviously at season two, they're still figuring out how Sheridan fits in because they got so used to Sinclair. By season three, they've got a dynamic, which is that they trust each other, but also will call each other on their bullshit, which I remember there's an arc later on with Garibaldi that becomes very interesting. I won't spoil that for people who haven't watched that far yet, but I remember Garibaldi goes to a really dark place at one point.
Yeah. So I purposely chose this one so that we wouldn't spoil the back half of the entire series.
Right. Yeah. So I'll stop there. But I just mentioned it again, just by memory. If you love this character arc stuff, it keeps going.
I think we're going to wrap up. We appreciate folks listening. Do you have any last comments or anything?
Other than that, I mean, I'll talk about kind of next episode because building on the whole character arcs and making hard decisions, if you apply that to Star Trek, you get Deep Space Nine. And so that's what we're going to talk about.
The best Star Trek.
What was that?
In my mind, it really is too. No, I'm with you on that. I think it's the best one too. Discovery's getting there for me, but Deep Space Nine is still the best for me. But since you want to do ahead of time, I'm going to recommend Duet, which is a season one episode, much like Babylon 5, season one is not great. You kind of need to, I would say Google the summary of the pilot, just so you know the setting of the scenario, because the pilot's job is setting the stage, but it's actually not really good. Duet is interesting because you start to see into specifically the relationship between one of the characters and the antagonistic race, the Cardassians. So that's a good one. And then to see where it goes to, I'm recommending a two-parter. Season 3, episodes 20 and 21, Improbable Cause and Die is Cast. mostly because it is shows you why the Taylor is the most interesting show character in the show. And then I am going to do a season 6 one, but it doesn't really spoil anything for the latter half of the show. But it's such a fantastic episode. It's Far Beyond the Stars, season 6, episode 13.
Oh, yes.
because it also shows that unlike Babylon 5, this is not as heavily serialized. And so occasionally it will do the Star Trek thing of just following a high concept idea. And Far Beyond the Stars is the best version of those high concept episodes. Bar none, it's frankly one of the best episodes of television I've ever watched, honestly.
Totally agreed.
So Duet, Improbable Cause, Dias Cast, and Far Beyond the Stars, 4 episodes, but I think that'll give you a really good spread of the depth and complexity of Deep Space Nine.
So something we forgot last time that we might want to do, if people want to follow you on social media, where can they find you?
Oh yeah, where you can find us. That'd be great. You can find me at pugsteady.com. That's PUGSTEADY.com. That's my professional website. You can find me on Twitter, also at Pugsteady. I'm sure we'll be chatting about the show on Twitter and other places. Oh, I'm also on Instagram as Eddie Fate, EDDYFATE.
If you're looking for me, you can find me at darker_hue on Twitter. I have a Facebook account. Oh, I have a Facebook page if you want to visit it. I myself visited on occasions. we've also got a Discord group that I recently started that should be in the Twitter bio. So if you want to talk about this, you want to talk about any of the work that I've done or general geekery, swing by. Otherwise, I think that is a wrap for this one.
Sounds good. And we'll see you all in a couple of weeks.